So I didn't get to meet all the visitors who are here this morning, but yeah, just something that's important to say every once in a while, maybe every time, although I don't say this every time at an assembly. Yeah, is that if there's ever anything from our assembly that seems unusual or out of the ordinary or seems worth asking about, which is really every part of it is worth asking about, we really care a lot about what the Bible says here, how worship in terms of what the church in the Bible looks like, how worship is instructed, how the church is structured and organized. We try to really care about ensuring that we're careful with what Jesus commanded, what the apostles commanded. So if there's anyone here that has any questions about anything, we would be super happy to talk more about why we do what we do here. Now, I've been doing a series this year on Ecclesiastes, where once a month I'll teach a lesson on Ecclesiastes. We go through the book. It's kind of convenient. It's 12 chapters. There's 12 months. So what that means is it's really one chapter at the beginning of each month. And just some introductory things to say about Ecclesiastes here is a question that I've asked, I think about every time we've opened Ecclesiastes, is when does someone's perspective have the power to change the way that you live, right? Someone's advice, or again, just how someone sees things, conclusions they come to, when do someone else's conclusions about life, about what's valuable, about what's worth investing yourself in, at what point do someone else's conclusions actually have the power to change how you see things? Because again, Ecclesiastes, it's not just like any book of the Bible, right? It's not just meant to be information that we agree with mentally and say, okay, yeah, I see how the preacher of Ecclesiastes came to that conclusion, sure. Really, everything in Ecclesiastes is meant to reorient things for us and have a practical impact on how we're living and what we're pursuing. And the reason I've titled this lesson, "What Are You Looking At?" I know that kind of seems like a clickbaity title. The reason is in chapters 1 and 2, the preacher started with personal experience, so he comes to conclusions about life and joy and fulfillment first, based on his personal experience. But if you look in chapter 3, he shifts from personal experience to wise observation. So look at chapter 3, verse 10. "I have seen the endeavor which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves." Look at verse 16, chapter 3, 16. "Furthermore, I have seen under the sun." And then you look at verse 22. "I have seen that nothing is better than that a man should be glad in his works." Look at chapter 4, verse 1. "Then I looked again." Verse 4, "I have seen." Verse 7, "Then I looked again." And then verse 15, "I have seen." So Solomon seems to be the writer of the book, seems to be the preacher. You know, again, he has a wide array of valuable experiences, but he also has an array of wise, trustworthy observations. You know, wisdom puts meaning in everything. Wisdom makes it where there's lessons to be learned everywhere in life, even outside of personal experience. And a part of the preacher's wisdom is he started the book saying that he was an extraordinarily wealthy individual, wealthier than any other king of Judah or Israel. He was wiser than any other king of Israel or Judah. And a lot of what he ends up observing is clearly outside of his personal experience, which is part of wisdom, right? Recognizing what is true, even if what is true does not match my experience, right? Because truth is not judged by my experience, right? And then something else, kind of a flow of thought leading up to this. So we're going to start, obviously, in chapter 4, if you're kind of aware of what we read in the scripture reading already. Verses 1 through 3 is very depressing, and Ecclesiastes does have very deliberately depressing conclusions that are necessary conclusions. But I want you to notice something. Look at chapter 2, verse 24, and this is relevant for leading up to chapter 4. Look at chapter 2, verse 24. It's kind of a momentum through Ecclesiastes that there's bad news, right, which is just closing the door on values, goals, and priorities that really actually aren't worth anything, so that what's left open is what we read in chapter 2:24. "There is nothing better than to eat and drink and have his soul see good, than for a man to eat and drink and to see good in his labor. This also I have seen is from the hand of God. Who can eat and drink and have enjoyment outside of him? Look at chapter 3, verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be glad and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all his labor, it is the gift of God. Look at verse 22. I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be glad in his work. That is his portion. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? So kind of where we're at in Ecclesiastes is the preacher is saying, you know, to be glad and have joy in life is actually a really good thing. But kind of the momentum of the book is it's good to be glad in your work. It's good to have joy, but. And that's what we're going to see in chapter 4. But I want you to see how this is going to be refined through the book. So in chapter 5, verse 18, just to show you that this is going to keep going and the preacher is going to keep coming back to this. So this isn't the end. Chapter 5, verse 18. Here is what I have seen to be good, which is beautiful, to eat, to drink, and to see good in all of one's labor in which he labors under the sun during the few years of his life, which God has given him, for this is his portion. And he actually continues on that note there through the end of chapter 5. Look at chapter 8, verse 15. So I laud gladness, for there is nothing better for the man under the sun except to eat, drink, and to be merry. This will join him in his labor. Chapter 9, verse 7, go then, eat your bread in gladness, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Chapter 11, verse 8, indeed, if a man should live many years, let him be glad in them all, and let him remember the days of darkness, they will be many. Verse 9, be glad, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be merry. So, okay, even though Ecclesiastes does have a lot of strong, we'll say, negative statements about life, there's still kind of a thread of gladness is possible, right? It's good to pursue it. It's just, well, where is it? You know, how do you arrive at the place of having real meaning and real gladness that actually isn't really meaningless or a mirage or actually hiding just deep foolishness under the surface, where your gladness is actually on the surface of a foundation of a foolish and ignorant perspective? Is it possible to have joy on the foundation of reality and truth? And the conclusion of the book is yes. And of course, that's with God above the sun. Anyway, so the end of chapter 3 was it's good to be glad, but chapter 4 is yes, but. So chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, like the title of the lesson, what are you looking at? A foolish person's perspective is very narrow, very immediate, very limited. And so Solomon in wisdom is going to look at what is very real, despite verse 22 of chapter 3, concluding that gladness is good, chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. Then I looked again at all the acts, and you notice all the acts of oppression, not just one or two, which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed. So again, not just that people were being oppressed, he saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. The New Living Translation will say they were helpless victims. Verse 2, so I lauded the dead who were already dead more than the living who are still living. But better off than both of them is the one who has never been, who has never seen the evil work which is done under the sun. All right, so something we've talked about already is when the preacher mentions this term under the sun, it's kind of like, okay, if we're to separate life under the sun as in just complete atheistic perspective, just eliminate God out of the picture, what do you get? You know, can you find meaning? Can you find joy under the sun? And he's obviously come to the conclusion already, no, you can't. So verses 1 through 3, note that this is under the sun. If you look back at chapter 3, not to move around too much here, he's already looked above the sun, that God is going to judge everything. So chapter 3, 16, furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said in my heart, God will judge both the righteous and the wicked man. For a time for every matter and every work is there. All right, so the preacher is not ignorant that every act of oppression will find its proper place in God's judgment. He's not ignorant of that. But again, we're looking at under the sun. So, okay, kind of the summary point of this is wisdom does not ignore, nor does it undermine the reality and the grief involved in the victims of oppression under the sun. You know, there's just so many things that Solomon, even as a king, there are really only so far he could go in helping the vulnerable or solving the problems of the oppressed. And you have to think, with Solomon's wealth, the preacher's wealth, could he have just ignored this? Just kind of lived within his opulent bubble of pleasure and industry and all the success that he mentioned he had been enjoying in chapter 2? Could he have just ignored this? Again, wisdom does not neglect the reality that some things in life are worth noticing that are bent and will never be straightened again. Now, I want you to think about this. In verse 2 and 3, is that a fair conclusion? Would you agree with Solomon, the preacher, that better off than the living then are the dead? Better off than anyone who is miscarried is the one who's actually never been existed in the first place, never existed even in the first place. And even though that can seem extreme, I want to make the point here that righteous people who were actively pursuing God and considering him actually said the same thing. Now, Solomon is saying this by way of observation, right? Wisdom, by implication, is empathetic. And again, not just self-centered in its perspective. It's willing to look at the reality of oppression. It's empathetic to that reality. It is impacted by that reality. But Job and Jeremiah are two people that experienced difficult things. And Job in Job 10, 18 and 19, he said, "Why then have you," he's praying, talking directly to God, "why then have you brought me out of the womb?" And this is after he lost everything, was covered in boils, whatnot. Job is very aware in his faith that like God could solve the problem and that God allowed all this to happen. So he sees this as between him and God. "Would that I had breathed my last and no eye had seen me. I should have been as though I had not been, carried from womb to tomb." Well, Jeremiah was an amazing prophet, an extremely righteous person who had a very deep and rich, trained faith in God. In Jeremiah 20, after he's already experienced so much growth in his faith, and mind you, in this chapter, there's praise that Jeremiah gives, but here's what he says at the end of chapter 20. "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let the day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Why did I ever come forth from the womb to look on trouble and sorrow so that my days have been spent in shame?" Exaggerations? You know, was that right for Jeremiah to express that? So again, I would argue that Solomon is coming to a wise conclusion, right? And I think it's difficult to empathize with what Solomon is feeling because of what he was seeing. Just like with Job, it's difficult to empathize with what he's feeling because of the extent of what he was experiencing. Same with Jeremiah. It's difficult to empathize with the extremity of his words because it's difficult to relate to the extreme nature of his circumstances. So, okay, just to make the case, Solomon's coming to a reasonable and wise conclusion. I don't think the point of the text is, well, I'm not sure I agree. I think the preacher is getting a little too extreme here, a little too emotional. The idea is, based on what he saw, this is the wise conclusion to what he saw under the sun. So, like we've talked about with other aspects of Ecclesiastes that are difficult, even emotionally difficult, is it a good thing or a bad thing? You know, is there a value to coming to terms with this? I think number one, it's so easy to take for granted something monumental Jesus said. I believe it's Matthew 5, verse 5. You know, so Solomon is saying here that under the sun, there are so many things that happen where there is no comfort. There's no justice. There's no judge. There's no person of power who's going to hear you and help you. There are so many things that are left undone and unnoticed, and all you get is to suffer, even oftentimes out of your control. Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 5, "Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted." And again, it's easy to read that and say, great, you know, it's really nice that he promised that. But I think a book like Ecclesiastes helps us better appreciate the weight of what Jesus said. Because again, Solomon is, even as an Israelite and a believer in God, you have the reality of God's role in humanity, But in wisdom, he's looking at life even separated from that. And do you think this would help Solomon at the end of all of this appreciate the conclusion, fear God and keep his commandments? Because even though man cannot solve every act of oppression, there is one who can. And even though people forget about the needy, ignore the oppressed, and life goes on, and life just tramples on the people who have nothing, is there one who will take note of those things and make that right? There's a time for every matter in God's judgment, right? So I would say it is healthy to come to terms with what Solomon was concluding here, because what this does is it shows the necessity of something more. So much of Ecclesiastes is really building on this theme that some things are bent and cannot be strengthened. Some things about life are never going to be fixed. And why is that? Because God created life to have a deliberate sense of tension to lead people to recognize we have a desperate need for something more. We want things to be fixed that are never going to get fixed. We want problems to be solved that are never going to be solved here. And what that's meant to do is lead us to look for something more, something above the sun and outside of the sphere of just the present reality. And then finally, just something worth kind of taking note of. Do you think the preacher is noticing something that God ignores? You know, sometimes like people, they raise the question, you know, what about this person in this place where they've never heard the gospel? What about the people in North Korea, you know, with their walls that guard their community from outsiders and outside culture? What about the people in there? You know, Solomon was distressed by the reality that there's oppression that exists in the world that is not right. And he wants that fixed, but under the sun, it can't be fixed. Again, do you think he's noticing something that God doesn't notice? Do you think he's seeing that there's a problem to be fixed that God is ignoring or neglecting? You know, Solomon is seeing something that God himself sees, right? 4 through 12, looking at labor under the sun. So again, 3:22 said, it's good to be glad in your work. It's good to be content. It's good to find joy. But it's still good to acknowledge in that life is broken and oppression exists. And a lot of times, even outside of anyone's particular control, can you still have joy in that reality? Ecclesiastes will answer that as a yes. But then what about work? It's good to be glad in work. Well, yes, but 4 through 12. I have seen that every labor and every success of the work is the result of jealousy between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. The fool folds his hand and embrace and consumes his own flesh. One handful of rest is better than two fists full of labor and striving after wind. Then I looked again at vanity under the sun, and this kind of illustrates the point. There was a certain man without a second man, having neither son nor brother, yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches. And for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of good? As in, he's not asking himself this question. This too is vanity, and it is a grievous endeavor. Two are better than one because they have good wages for their labor. It's a blink and you miss it moment, but so often in Ecclesiastes he says, there is no advantage. There is no actual good outcome. So for here to say, this gives you a good wage, this is a monumental statement in verse 9, and it relates to just intimate relationship, not work or career or achievement. Verse 10, for if either of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not a second one to lift him up. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? And if one can overpower him who is alone, two can stand against him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. With 9 through 12, just kind of briefly here, think about how 7 through 8, he's talking about a man who is alone and not kind of considering the nature of his condition. And then 9 through 12 kind of addresses the problem of really being alone. But all right, 4 through 12. Wisdom recognizes the delusions that can be involved in work, and obviously in overworking or not thinking about work in its proper perspective without also thinking the solution is just to give up and be lazy, right? So verse 4, you know, again, this is a wise conclusion. If we don't see it, the problem is I'm not seeing what wisdom is able to see, that every success and achievement and labor is ultimately at its core motivated by some form of jealousy between one person and another. So that's a problem, right? But is the solution to then just give up on working hard? No, in verse 5, the fool just folds his hands in and does nothing, and that just ends up being self-destructive. But then verse 6, you can also get out of balance, you know, and overwork, and one handful of rest, though, is better than two hands full of striving after the wind. So I think the idea is wisdom, there's going to be times where we're going to have to catch ourselves being out of balance. And I want to ask you, are you able to recognize when your life is out of balance? Because I think in Ecclesiastes 4, verse 5, some people, they lean into laziness, and they need to catch themselves on that. Be honest about that. Work harder. Some people, though, in verse 6, their solution is to work really hard and overwork, and really, they need to pull back on the way that they're valuing work or how much time they're investing in work. You know, in verse 4, I think kind of gets the idea that this can be hard to notice because we're all pulled into this. This is what's normal. And I've thought about illustrating this. So this is, again, this is kind of an imperfect illustration, but again, how something can be so common and it becomes invisible or just not noticeable anymore. Have you guys ever been in a house or in an environment where you're not familiar with it, but it smells awful? But nobody there recognizes the smell because they're just so familiar with it, right? So in Garden City here, so like I know when I enter Garden City from 516 to Augusta Road because sometimes the mill is going and there's this awful smell in the air. There's neighborhoods that have to deal with that. You know, in Jessup, there's a paper mill in Jessup. And if you don't know, paper mills, they exude horrible smells in Jessup. But, you know, people, they just get used to it. They don't notice it, right? So verse 4, that can be like kind of what motivates work ethic in the world is ultimately, at its core, jealousy, which, again, we get so familiar with, we get so accustomed to it that it becomes invisible. So again, the solution isn't to just think like the world thinks, work like the world works. The solution isn't to be too lazy. The solution isn't to work too hard. So we come back to the need for balance. But the point to get back to in that is because of all of this, we're all going to have a sense of honesty with needing to catch ourselves when our lives are out of balance. So I want to illustrate this with 7 through 12. So he mentions this person who, again, just how contagious this is to just focus on work and success and career when this person is all alone and he's not asking himself, who am I doing this for? Like, what's the point of how I'm doing this? I want to illustrate this in a couple ways. Number one, when I used to work at UPS, I was a manager at UPS, and there were levels of management that just go higher and higher. And I remember the next step of management in my career, which I didn't take, I was told forthrightly by someone above me that the divorce rate is nearly 100% of people in the position, one step higher than where I was. And I had seen that. Most of those guys were divorced. So basically the idea is if you want to get further into this company, you have to accept the fact that it's either choose this company or choose your marriage. I was single at the time, but I was still like, yeah, that's gonna take way too much of myself. I'm not gonna sell my soul to the company, right? But a lot of people do. It's normal, right? It's normal to make those sacrifices. It seems as successful to make those sacrifices. But the reality is it's just not wise to neglect something more important with what is less important. I want to illustrate this in another way. I once was involved with a brother many years ago, and this brother in Christ, we would study sometimes one-on-one, and this brother would never come to assemblies, ever. And when we would study one-on-one sometimes, he would always say, I have to work. I have to work. And he would say, I'm trying to get off, but I have to work. And I'm telling you, he would never come to assembly. So him like working it out with his boss, it never happened. Would it surprise you that that brother completely fell away? Again, it's just not wise to neglect something more important, something less important. Is work important? Yes. You know, the preacher isn't saying that work isn't important, right? He's saying you just need to be wise and balanced and recognize You can get carried away really easily because that's the culture of the world, is get carried away with work, success, and achievement. Now, the hard thing is, it's easy to say that not being there, right? The hard thing is to take what he's saying and say, if I'm there, I may need to actually start pulling back and making sacrifices to make sure my life is in proper alignment with what has real value, right? So again, you don't want to be the person in verses 7 and 8. They're just thoughtlessly ignoring what's more important by just drinking on the well of the world and being drunk on the success of the world, ultimately leading nowhere and robbing him of verses 9 through 12, how companionship exceeds income and achievement. You know, one of the things that Solomon gets to here that is a truth outside of circumstance is when he mentions rejoicing in the wife of your youth, just having intimate companionship. Do you remember how many wives Solomon had? He had hundreds, about 1,000 wives and concubines, right? But what Solomon recognizes is life is ultimately about intimate, well-built relationships. Did you know that? That's how Jesus spends his ministry, cultivating deeply rooted, godly relationships. Because Jesus recognized that was the most important thing. That doesn't mean we can't cultivate that, like working a full-time career, working hard. Again, it's about balance. But within everything, just recognizing in verse 9, you know, companionship is where a good wage is found. Not in income, not in world achievements or life achievements. Because in verse 10, ultimately we're going to fall and need help back up. We're going to be cold in different ways and need others to keep us warm. We're going to be opposed and need the support and encouragement of other people around us to help us. So again, ultimately, our greatest need is not a great income, not an over-success in our career, but again, to be balanced, to be content, to work hard, and ultimately to recognize that life's most valuable income is the income of invested intimate relationships. 13 through 16, looking at culture. It's kind of an interesting parable-like observation that the preacher makes here in verses 13 through 16. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive warning. For he, seemingly talking about the poor lad, for he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. I have seen all the living who walk about under the sun go along with the second lad who stands in place of him. There is no end to all the people, to all who are before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be glad with them. But this too is vanity and striving after the wind. So this is one of those better but statements, right? So I don't think the premise in verse 13 is actually ultimately the point. But a poor, wise person is better than an old, experienced, but foolish king who doesn't know how to listen, receive instruction or warning anymore. But verse 14, again, how this kind of is almost like a parable situation. So then you have this poor lad seemingly in verse 14 being the one who has almost like a Cinderella story, right? They come out of prison, and through their wisdom or whatever, they end up replacing the king. Wow, what a dramatic, what an amazing story. And if he indeed has wisdom, I'm sure that is going to benefit the area or culture where he's ruling. But then that's not the end in verse 16. There's no end to all the people. So eventually those people aren't going to be happy with this poor, wise lad who replaced that old and foolish king. And just like Ecclesiastes 1, some things are bent and can't be fixed. Things just repeat on cycles over and over again. Ultimately, when a problem seems fixed, actually, whoops, it's not. The same problem is just repeating over and over again. So I think the point is this. Wisdom recognizes the danger of seeing life through the lens of cultural movements and just culture in general or public opinion. And that's really difficult. You know, so one ruler is old and foolish. So imagine during that time in culture, people could say, ugh, things are so much worse than they used to be. And then when the young, inexperienced, but wise lad gets out of prison and becomes king, you think, wow, this is so exciting. Things are finally getting so much better. Well, then public opinion changes in verse 16. And a new group of people arise. Maybe you're still alive. And they're not happy with him. And then you think, ah, things are getting so much worse than they used to be now. Do you think that changes the reality of what Solomon said in verses 1 through 3? Or any other kind of established, universal, constant truth mentioned in Ecclesiastes? This gets to something he says in chapter 7, verse 10, right? And again, the danger of seeing things through a cultural lens. Because culturally, things go up and down. They're always changing. But in Ecclesiastes, reality ultimately never changes. Look at chapter 7, verse 10. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? Which, by the way, I see things like that said on Facebook all the time. For it is not from wisdom that you talk about this or ask about this. Do you get that? Because what Solomon is saying, the preacher is saying, is that in Ecclesiastes, no cultural movement ever really changes humanity's real problems. No single ruler, no great king ever actually fixes life's real problems. They can fix some things, or maybe for a time it seems like things are getting better, but they're just going to get worse again. And some cultural issue might be fixed for a time, but that cultural issue is just going to get bad again. It's just going to come back again, right? So again, ultimately, I think what the preacher is saying back in chapter 4, 13 through the end of the chapter, is there can be some exciting moments in culture. There's going to be some bad kings, then, oh man, we have a good ruler all of a sudden. But you know what? You're going to have a bad one again. Think about Israel's history. It was exciting when there was a king like David, when there was a king like Solomon. It was exciting, well, Solomon for some time. There's kings like Jehoshaphat who are good kings, kings like Hezekiah who are good kings. But then they're followed by kings like Ahaz and Manasseh who sacrificed their own children and burned them in a fire to idol worship immediately after following a really good king who served God. So again, the lens of culture, if culture forms our values, that is a foolish lens to navigate reality through. So again, no earthly ruler can be our savior. Nobody on earth is going to ever solve humanity's real problems. And to see it any differently is to have a very narrow, very shallow perspective. And again, I don't want to go too much into this. But again, I have some forms of social media. And wow, the amount of political vitriol that goes on Facebook constantly is very discouraging, right? Because it's easy to get upset about political things and political decisions. But again, the perspective of Ecclesiastes is, think about what matters the most. And obviously, Jesus fulfilled those things in his ministry, right? How did Jesus navigate his culture? Was Jesus living in a time when things were politically good? You know, do you know what kind of king Herod was? What kind of moral person Herod was? This is why in Jesus' culture, there was something called the Zealots, where it was people that they really, really wanted to overthrow the government of Herod, right? Did you know that one of Jesus' disciples was a zealot? And it does seem by implication that his zealotness kind of got redirected into a different direction as he followed Jesus. Because again, Jesus lifted to a higher place your concerns, your priorities. He changed what problems you see are the problems to pursue passionately. What things is God actually trying to solve? What's worth your energy? What's worth your time? And then with how turbulent cultural things can be, you know, Jesus navigated a shifting and dramatic culture on the basis of eternal truth. You know, Jesus didn't ignore the cultural issues of his day. He interacted with the Pharisees and their traditions. He interacted even with Herod. He interacted with people who had problems with the political climate of his day. But how did he do that? Not by getting pulled into it, not by letting that define his perspective, but by trying to interact with people in his culture, trying to point them to the kingdom of God. and trying to help them to raise their sense of priority, right? And then even beyond all that, Jesus is king. And again, that's not just theory or theology. That's not just information that intellectually matters. You know, the full glory and the full effect of Jesus ruling as king is as true now as the day that he ascended to heaven. You know, so the drama of chapter 4, verse 13 through the end of the chapter, that kings come and go, the quality of those kings change, public opinion changes, and things are always just fluctuating uncontrollably beyond what any single person can control. Jesus' rule and the effect of that rule is not determined by public opinion. You know, the reality of the impact of Jesus' rule doesn't change based on cultural movements or who's president at any given particular time. The full effect of Jesus' kingdom is constant. So the obligation then is to recognize how to interact with Jesus' kingdom first and our culture secondary to that, right? And that's the good news of Ecclesiastes. That's where he ends up through the book. Again, we're in chapter 4, so he's building points. But he's going to mention the ultimate conclusion is fear God. You know, things in the culture are going to come and go. The values of the world are going to shift in any direction. But you know what is constant? Is the authority of God and the authority of his word, right? That's where we'll end the lesson. So in Ecclesiastes, some of the things that are said in the book don't always demand some radical life change, right? Not every teaching is a major shift in our life. But I want to think about this. How do you feel getting scammed, let's say, out of $100? Why do we check our rearview mirrors in our blind spot as we're driving on the roads? Because sometimes there's more nuanced things in life where it doesn't destroy my life and make me bankrupt to be scammed out of $100. You know, tapping on someone's car or getting in an accident because I didn't check my blind spot doesn't necessarily ruin my life, but it's something I certainly want to avoid, right? The preacher in Ecclesiastes is encouraging us to raise our expectation on what to get out of life and how to live our lives, and that should matter to us. We're very thoughtful about so many things that we involve ourselves in with life, and yet with life are oftentimes negligent in applying the kind of wisdom we read about in this book. So I encourage you with that, take the things in chapter 4, try to utilize those things in any way that helps you navigate life with more godly wisdom. Let's pray about these things, and afterward we'll extend the invitation.